And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here. Unfortunately, I'm not in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Free Radio Santa Cruz doesn't currently have a studio. If you can help with that, let us know. It is Thursday, September 24th. And let's get started here. Have a pencil and paper ready, because you never know when you're going to need it to write down some information that you want to remember later. Names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, times, dates. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, September 26th at 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. They'll be at Natural Bridges State Park. Linda writes, "We will be continuing our work on removing invasive non-native ice plant in the dunes. Ann and Pat will be co-leaders. I will be leading the day at work, and I will see you next time. Come out and give your support to the team leaders and help restore a little bit of coastal bluff habitat. How to get there? Take Highway 1, which is also known as Mission Street West, through Santa Cruz, and continue to Swift Street at the edge of town. Turn left and go down until you reach the ocean. Make a right turn on West Cliff Drive. Go to the end of West Cliff Drive, turn right, and pull in to the first available parking space. Walk into the park, and they will meet you at the sand parking lot on your left, just past the fee kiosk. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary, just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine. It might possibly be shine this time, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Please bring your gloves and water. Any questions, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 462-4041. You could email her at redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at pacbell.net, or go to the webpage at www.cruzcnps.org. That's CRUZCNPS.org. And coming up on Thursday, October 1st, the screening of the movie Wrenched, How Edward Abbey Lit the Flame of Environmental Activism and Gave the Movement Its Soul. This is a special fundraiser for the Ventana Wilderness Alliance. And the screening will take place at 7 p.m. at the Del Mar Theater in downtown Santa Cruz. Tickets are $20 in advance at vwawrenched.brownpapertickets.com. That's vwawrenched.brownpapertickets.com. If you want to know more about the movie, go to wrenched-themovie.com. That's wrenched-themovie.com. The event is hosted by the Ventana Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit dedicated to the conservation of public lands in the Big Sur backcountry. Nancy Abbey, a local activist and educator, will give a live introduction, and proceeds benefit the Ventana Wilderness Alliance. For more information, go to www.ventanawild.org. Once again, the movie Wrenched, screening at the Del Mar Theater at 7 p.m. on Thursday, October 1st. Get your tickets in advance at vwawrenched.brownpapertickets.com or $25 at the door. And voting is still open for Intercontinental Cry's annual People Land Truth Awards. These are awards presented for excellence in the field of investigative journalism. The voting ends on October 1st, so go to their website, www.intercontinentalcry.org. That's intercontinentalcry.org/PLT Awards. Once again, intercontinentalcry.org/PLT Awards. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Unfortunately, they're remembering Marcus Calvin Baker, born 1975 and has recently passed. As though a star suddenly dropped out of Orion's belt, or spring passed without the birth of a new buffalo, or bread was suddenly outlawed from the cabin, our family has lost a constant, a person by whom we measured ourselves and gauged our level of dedication and energy. Marcus Calvin Baker was born in 1975 and grew up in the Piedmont region of North Carolina in the city of Winston-Salem. While this writer possesses little information about his early endeavors, one fact remains uncontested. He played the trombone. On leaving his native southeastern mixed forests in the early 1990s, Marcus managed to reach the evergreens of Oregon, where he cut his teeth as a tree sitter, gaining the skills of an expert climber and ruckus maker. His boundless energy and dedication to the environment and social justice then led him to work with Seeds of Peace, traveling throughout the Northwest and Southwest to provide logistical and culinary support to campaigns of all stripes. He lent his energy to the annual Peace Camp at the Nevada nuclear test site outside of Las Vegas, as well as to supporting Dene elders in maintaining their traditional ways of life on the Black Mesa in Arizona. His affiliation with Seeds varied in intensity but continued through the years, and you should have tasted his pulled roadkill deer tacos. The existential threats facing the largest contiguous roadless area in the country drew him to Idaho, where his relentless energy and ingenuity were a great benefit to the Cove Mallard and Otter Wing struggles. According to one fellow activist, Marcus executed incredible feats of defiance in the Otter Wing tree sits, which often involved more than 8 miles of bushwhacking into the woods with insanely heavy supplied packs in order to stop the original construction of the road into that pristine area. He always showed concern and love for the people who joined the fight with him, while at the same time demonstrating empathy for the people who were just trying to work in the woods and support their families. The exact origin of his woods name, Chipmunk, is the subject of some controversy. It's been said he earned the name in Oregon due to his tendency to leave caches of food, gear, and other useful items hidden throughout his habitat. He once told the writer that the name referred to his ability to subsist entirely on a diet of nuts and seeds, which the writer found highly suspect given the massive amounts of elk, deer, trout, salmon, and grouse that I'd watched him consume. Or maybe it was something about those front teeth of his. As we struggle to nail down a precise answer, I can almost hear his lilting counsel. Hard telling, not knowing. During his time with Seeds of Peace, Marcus learned about the work of the Buffalo Field Campaign in West Yellowstone, Montana, where the last wild free-roaming family of buffalo remains under persistent threat. He traveled there and set down the tiny rootlings contiguous over the next 2 decades to define a roadless area. Although he was an enthusiastic, if often curmudgeonly, cornerstone of the campaign, helping to endeavor to maintain a consistent and responsive form in spite of a highly itinerant population. From providing hundreds of pounds of wild fish and game to sawing and bucking cords upon cords of firewood to fastidiously maintaining a sprawling network of shoveled trails through the deep snow around the cabin, Marcus often worked behind the scenes to ensure that other people could effectively go about their work. And then he'd suddenly be right in front of the scenes, loudly engaging Department of Livestock officers with a kind of high-spirited verbal antagonism that typically built up the joy and courage of his mates while steadily grinding down the value of that government paycheck. A tripod village, a Bozeman jail, hunger strikes, sleeping dragons, and all-night ski patrols, these were among the myriad ways he gave his life energy to the buffalo. And then there was the time a found government radio spent the entire day broadcasting Grateful Dead to the agents throughout the field, but who knows if he had anything to do with that. There were so many people and places touched by this man that some will necessarily be left out of this account. He was simply too expansive, his chapters too numerous, his relationships too intricate, his complexity too great. We love you, Marcus, and we will keep talking with you. Stand on the front lines with the buffalo. Volunteers are needed for the upcoming field season. The Buffalo Field Campaign has seasonal openings for field volunteers. We have openings for every season, but are in great need of folks during our field season, which runs from November through May. This time of year, when wild bison are migrating into Montana and facing death and harassment, any buffalo within Montana's borders is in danger of being shot on sight, hazed, captured, and shipped to the slaughterhouse. All volunteers are provided room, board, gear, and training in exchange for staffing our field patrols. They cater to most any dietary need, from roadkill to vegan tofu. We are located in a warm cabin by beautiful Hebgen Lake, just a few miles outside of West Yellowstone, Montana, and we also run a camp north of Yellowstone in the Gardner Basin. Visit our website to learn more and make your plans. See you on the front lines. The Buffalo Field Campaign's website, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. Go there to figure out what they need or what you need to do to get there. If you have something to donate, send it to the Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Or you could give them a call, area code 406-646-0070. That's Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, 59758. Or call 406-646-0070. You can find this information and more at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And do remember, the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And unfortunately, sage grouse have been denied endangered species listing. This story from Environment News Service. The greater sage grouse does not face the risk of extinction now or in the foreseeable future, so the bird does not need protection under the Endangered Species Act at this time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has decided. Voluntary conservation efforts will be enough to keep the species alive, the agency says. Greater sage grouse once occupied more than 290 million acres of sagebrush in the West. Early European settlers reported seeing millions of the birds take to the skies. But the ground-dwelling grouse, known for its unique mating ritual, has lost almost half of its habitat since then. Despite losses, sage grouse populations are still relatively large and well-distributed across the range, the Fish and Wildlife Service says. If a species is listed under the Act, federal agencies cannot authorize, fund, or carry out actions that destroy or adversely modify critical habitats. Because large-scale development, logging, and mining projects on private and state land typically require federal permits, they become subject to the Endangered Species Act's critical habitat regulations. The Fish and Wildlife Service's decision not to list the greater sage grouse leaves its sagebrush habitat open to development, even though federal officials say the largest voluntary land conservation effort in U.S. history will protect the unique bird. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell made the announcement at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge, accompanied by four governors and numerous federal officials. In person and in video on Twitter, Secretary Jewell explained that an unprecedented landscape-scale conservation effort across the western United States has reduced threats to the greater sage grouse across 90% of its breeding habitat. This led the Fish and Wildlife Service to conclude that the bird does not warrant Endangered Species Act protection. The success was only possible through close collaboration among Western states, the Department of Interior, the United States Department of Agriculture, and more than 1,100 ranchers across 11 states, said Jewell. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's September 30th deadline to review the status of the greater sage grouse spurred numerous federal agencies, the 11 states in its range, and dozens of public and private partners to undertake a campaign to protect, restore, and enhance important sage grouse habitat to preclude the need to list the species. Today's decision reflects the joint efforts by countless ranchers and partners who have worked so hard to conserve wildlife habitat and preserve the Western way of life, said Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Together, we have shown that voluntary efforts joining the resources of private landowners, federal and state agencies, and partner organizations can help drive landscape-level conservation that is good for sage-grouse, ranching operations, and rural communities, Vilsack said, not mentioning oil and gas development, however. Through the government's sage-grouse initiative, more than 1,100 ranchers have restored and conserved roughly 4.4 million acres of key habitat. The U.S. Department of Agriculture expects voluntary private land conservation efforts to reach 8 million acres by the year 2018, Vilsack noted. On private and federal lands, government agencies have received commitments on 5.5 million acres through candidate conservation agreements. Many of these projects also improve grazing and water supplies for ranchers, benefiting cattle herds and the future of ranching in the West. Conservation efforts include a comprehensive strategy to fight rangeland fires and protect critical water resources, important in an area of drought and water shortages that impact communities across the West. These collective conservation efforts will protect sagebrush habitat shared by more than 350 other wildlife species, including mule deer, elk, pronghorn antelope, songbirds, and golden eagles. More than 1,100 ranchers are voluntarily working with federal and state agencies to conserve the greater sage grouse. Since 2010, USDA has partnered with these landowners to conserve or restore 4.4 million acres of key habitat through programs that provide financial assistance for conservation, and hundreds of other properties are enrolled through similar state or federal programs. The BLM and Forest Service today announced that they have issued records of decisions finalizing 98 land use plans that will help conservation conserve greater sage-grouse habitat, and support sustainable economic development on portions of public lands in 10 western states. The BLM and U.S. Forest Service also began a public comment process associated with their proposal to withdraw a subset of lands that are sage-grouse strongholds from future mining claims. Still, these efforts do not go far enough for some environmentalists. Eric Molvar, a wildlife biologist with the nonprofit group Wild Earth Guardians, says the government plans leave the greater sage-grouse and other rangeland species exposed to fossil fuel extraction, grazing, and development. Instead of ensuring a future for the greater sage-grouse, said Molvar, the final plans are replete with crippling flaws and loopholes, rendering them inadequate to address threats from industrial development, livestock grazing, and invasive weeds. The sage-grouse faces huge problems from industrial development and livestock grazing across the West, and now the Interior Department seems to be squandering a major opportunity to put science before politics and solve these problems, noted Molvar. And more opposition is on the way from another direction. The Blue Ribbon Coalition, a nonprofit that champions motorized recreational exploration, said the decision not to list the sage-grouse is headed for the courts. Don Amador, Western representative for the coalition, said, while agency leadership is proclaiming a great victory and collaborative success story, the reality is we shall all be soon mired in avoidable litigation. It is far from certain that the listing decision will survive judicial scrutiny, said Amador, and even if it does, the decision comes at a great and uncertain price in the form of sweeping land use plan amendments that were crammed through without significant and sufficient public input. And Interpol wanted poaching vessel the Kunlun and its illegal catch have escaped from Thailand. Captains Peter Hammerstadt and Sid Chakravarti of Sea Shepherd have called on the Australian and New Zealand authorities and the relevant international enforcement agencies to ensure the missing Interpol purple-listed toothfish poaching vessel Tai Shan, formerly called the Kunlun, does not disappear after going on the run from Thailand. The vessel had been under arrest in Phuket since March when it attempted to offload 182 tons of illegally caught Patagonian toothfish, which they listed as grouper. Since then, Thai authorities have used the country's national laws to keep the Tai Shan in port. However, given the limited application of the law to international fisheries crimes, the vessel was subsequently reloaded with her catch and was kept at anchor for the past 5 months. Citing the first possible opportunity, the vessel eluded local Thai authorities and escaped from custody on the 8th of September. Operation Icefish campaign leaders warn there is a high risk the illegal cargo of toothfish will be sold on the black market and that the poaching vessel will now return to the Antarctic. Reports that the catch of the Tai Shan sister vessels, the Yongding and Songhua, have disappeared without a trace indicate that enough loopholes exist for the illegal vessels to continue to operate once they are no longer under the surveillance of authorities. The Tai Shan was one of six internationally wanted toothfish poaching vessels targeted by Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in the organization's epic Southern Ocean Defense Campaign Operation Icefish. The Tai Shan had a long history of suspected fishing violation and is believed to have links to known Spanish crime syndicate Vidal Armadores. The vessel had been the target of several international incidents and run-ins with authorities in the lead-up to its detention. And for more information, go to www.seashepherd.org.au. And Sea Shepherd has successfully led hundreds of dolphins and pilot whales away from the killing beaches in the Faroe Islands. Over the past 3 months, the Sea Shepherd ships Bridget Bardot, San Simon, and more recently the Bob Barker, in collaboration with the Sea Shepherd land crew, have successfully escorted hundreds of dolphins, including pilot whales, away from the killing beaches of the Faroe Islands. This week alone, pods of pilot whales, white-sided dolphins, white-beaked dolphins, and bottlenose dolphins have been led away from the shores of the archipelago by Sea Shepherd ships. These species are four of the six that, according to local regulations, can be targeted for slaughter in the infamous drive hunt known as the Grindrap. All of the pods were located close to the island's shores and, as such, were at high risk of being spotted by locals and reported to authorities for slaughter. Chief Executive Officer of Sea Shepherd Global, Captain Alex Cornelison, said, "Our crews are under constant watch by authorities in the Faroe Islands, including the Danish Navy ships and helicopters. It's incredibly difficult to undertake these kinds of exercises without detection, but we have had huge successes in leading these pods of dolphins and pilot whales away from the killing beaches and out of harm's way. A pod of Risso's dolphins was also escorted to open sea last Wednesday. While this species is not listed as a target species, Grindrap records indicate that Risso's dolphins have been targeted for slaughter in the past. Most recently in the year 2010, 21 Risso's dolphins were slaughtered on the killing beach of Havalba in the south side of the archipelago. The slaughter of cetaceans is outlawed throughout the European Union, including Denmark, in accordance with Appendix 2 of the Convention on the Conservation of European Wildlife and Natural Habitats, the Bern Convention. However, in the Faroe Islands, a protectorate of Denmark, the slaughter of pilot whales and other small cetaceans continues with the assistance of the Danish police and navy and with the apparent blessing of the Danish government. Throughout this campaign, we have highlighted time and time again that the Danish government's ongoing support of the Grindrap is in breach of its international legal obligations and EU responsibilities. While Denmark continues to try to silence Sea Shepherd's opposition to the slaughters, our crews remain focused on the job at hand, defending the dolphins and whales that are still under threat in the Faroe Islands, said Captain Cornelissen. Sea Shepherd crews are currently in the Faroe Islands for the organization's sixth pilot whale defense campaign, Operation Sledup Grindini, which is scheduled to conclude at the end of September. For more information, go to www.seashepherd.org. That's www.seashepherd.org. And the Ca'apoor of Brazil are using arrows, bows, and sabotage and GPS to defend the Amazon from logging, in this story by Jonathan Watts of The Guardian, as found on the Earth First Newswire. With bows, arrows, and GPS trackers and camera traps, an indigenous community in northern Brazil is fighting to achieve what the government has long failed to do, halt illegal logging in their corner of the Amazon. The Ca'apoor, a tribe of about 2,200 people in the Maranhão state, have organized a militia of forest guardians to follow a strategy of nature conservation through aggressive confrontation. Logging trucks and tractors that encroach upon their territory, the 530,000 hectare, that's about 1 million acres, Alto Tiracu indigenous land, are intercepted and burned. Drivers and chainsaw operators are warned never to return. Those who fail to heed the advice are stripped and beaten. It is dangerous work, since the tribe decided to manage their own protection in 2011. They say the theft of timber has been reduced, but 4 Ca'apoor have been murdered, and more than a dozen others have received death threats. The Ca'apoor are seeking support through non-governmental organizations and the media. Earlier this month, The Guardian was among the first group of foreign journalists and Greenpeace activists who were invited to see how they live and operate. Reaching their land was a long haul. After flying to São Luís, the capital of Maranhão State, it took more than 8 hours to drive along a potholed highway flanked by cattle farms and palm plantations before turning off on a bumpy dirt track through the deforested land until the dense thicket of jungle marked the limit of Ca'apoor territory. The path was so close to the foliage here that branches constantly scraped and scratched the sides of our 4x4 until finally, just a few minutes before midnight, we emerged into a clearing bathed in moonlight. This was Jaxa Perixarenda, one of 8 former logging camps that have been taken over by the Ca'apoor and settled by a handful of families so the timber thieves cannot return. It was very simple, 6 thatched roofs under which families slept in hammocks. Living in such outposts is a sacrifice. Longer established villages have electricity, health centers, football pitches, and satellite dishes. Jaxa Perixarenda is bereft of such creature comforts. But it is a key part of a drive to regain territory, independence, and respect, all of which have been steadily eroded by loggers for more than 2 decades. Alto Tiracu, which covers an area equal to Delaware or 3 times that of Greater London, is a vulnerable and lucrative target. Although 8% has already been cleared, the indigenous land contains about half of the Amazon forest left in the Maranhão state. This includes much sought-after trees like ipê, also known as Brazilian walnut, which can fetch almost $1,500 per cubic meter after processing and export. The Ca'apoor have asked the Brazilian government to protect their borders, which were recognized in 1982. Last year, a federal court ordered the authorities to set up security posts, but nothing has been done, prompting the community to organize self-defense missions. In the morning, one of the forest guardians, Tiduin Ca'apoor, who, like all leaders of the group, asked to have his name changed to avoid being targeted by loggers, explains what happens when they encounter the loggers. Sometimes it's like a film. They fight us with machetes, but we always drive them off, he says. We tell them, we're not like you, we don't steal your cows, so don't steal our trees. The main weapons used by the Kaapoor are bows and arrows and borduna, a heavy sword-shaped baton. One of the group also owns a rusty old rifle. Mostly, though, they depend on the greater numbers. Tidwin Kaapoor takes us to a charred truck and tractor that the group burned in a confrontation a little over a week earlier and uses the ashes to paint his face. This gives us strength, one of his associates said. The Kaapoor are thought to have set fire to about a dozen loggers' vehicles. Further along the road, they build a pyre of planks seized inside their land, douse it with gasoline, and then watch it burn. Another of the group's leaders, Mirate Kaapoor, says the use of violence, which has resulted in some broken bones but no deaths among the loggers, is justified. The loggers come here to steal from us, so they deserve what they get. We have to make them feel our loss, the loss of our timber, the destruction of our forests. Compared with the past, he said the missions were effective. Our struggle is having results because the loggers respect us now. But the loggers also appear to be responding with lethal force. On the 26th of April, a former chieftain, Esabio Kaapoor, was murdered by gunmen on his way back from his visit with his brother. Like most killings of indigenous people and environmental activists in Brazil, the crime has not been solved, but the dead man's son has little doubt who is responsible and what they were trying to achieve. He was a target because the loggers thought he was the main leader of the group, says Iraun Kaapoor. They thought the Kaapoor would stop if they killed him, but we will continue with our work of protection. We're not afraid. This is our home, our land, and our forest. 10 days before we arrived, Iraun received a death threat and was told that the bullet that killed his father had been meant for him. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. Tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow afternoon to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM or www.freakradio.org at 3 o'clock every Friday. If you're in Moscow, Idaho, tune in to 90.3 KRFP at a new time, 1:15 on Wednesdays after Democracy Now! That's 1:15 p.m. Wednesday afternoon on Free Radio Moscow. Or you could go to radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous podcasts of the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is normally produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, but we're homeless right now. So if you know where you can find a studio for Free Radio, there is a $500 reward. Please send an email to frsc@freakradio.org. Thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.